Hello and welcome to the September 10th edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the engineer and producer of the show, and you are listening to KTOO News. Today, we will find out about Sunday's open house at the Shambhala Center and an upcoming workshop weekend for teens. Philip Durking will talk about his experiences in Africa. We'll get a preview of Wednesday's Juno World Affairs Council presentation, and we'll find out about Juno Douglas High School's trip to the Fringe Fest in Scotland. Weather, rest of today is cloudy. Tonight is rain, patchy fog. Tomorrow, cloudy. Wednesday night, rain. Thursday, mostly cloudy. And Thursday night and Friday, partly cloudy. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in just a little bit.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Oklahoma's highest court has ruled a little girl in the middle of a two-state custody battle can stay with her father for now. KGOU's Kurt Gortney has the latest update on the ongoing case.
The Oklahoma Supreme Court has granted an emergency stay to keep 3-year-old Veronica with her biological father, Dustin Brown, at least for now. A docket for the state Supreme Court shows the stay came after a lower court's ruling Friday that Veronica should be transferred immediately to Matt and Melanie Capobianco. Veronica's birth mother put her up for adoption. Brown has pursued custody under the federal Indian Child Welfare Act. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that law, intended to keep Native American children with tribal families, did not apply in this case. The Cherokee Nation has been supporting Brown and providing an attorney to represent Veronica's best interests. Brown and the Capobiancos were in a Nowata County court on Friday. Following that hearing, attorneys for Brown filed a writ of prohibition in the Oklahoma Supreme Court. Neither side is able to comment on the case due to a gag order. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney in Oklahoma City.
The Labor Day weekend began with several powerful storms across South Dakota. The Pine Ridge Reservation suffered damage from a possible tornado. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Friday night's storm followed one of the hottest weeks in South Dakota history. Temperatures routinely hit the upper 90s to above 100 degrees in parts of the state. On southwest South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation, two homes were reported destroyed, with several more homes damaged. Officials with the Red Cross say they worked to find shelter for nearly 24 tribal residents displaced by the bad weather. No injuries were reported. The severe storm was another in a series of devastating weather events this year. Three homes were destroyed by a tornado in the reservation community of Allen in late May. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
The Sioux Valley Dakota Nation signs agreements to attain self-governance. Leaders from the First Nation, the Canadian government, and the Manitoba government signed agreements last week to remove the nation from portions of the Indian Act. It will provide the nation greater control over decision-making on things like economic development, land management, education, and other issues. The parties have negotiated on the agreements for more than 20 years. The First Nation is the first in Manitoba to make a self-government agreement. The next step is provincial and federal legislation to bring the agreements into effect. Sioux Valley Dakota Nation has nearly 2,500 members, with about 56% living on reserve. The governor of Alaska has declared an economic disaster for residents of St. Lawrence Island. According to the Associated Press, Sean Parnell recently made the declaration because of a historically low walrus harvest. Parnell says 340 walrus were taken during the spring harvest, which is 36% of the average for the last 10 years. The harvest is causing a significant economic challenge to local residents. Walrus are a subsistence food source, and their ivory is used for carving, a significant regional economic driver, says Parnell. No emergency funds are available for immediate access, but the legislature could appropriate money for assistance. Native golfer Nota Begay's foundation, NB3, has announced a new national initiative to combat childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes among Native children. The plan includes expanding research and advocacy initiatives and assisting tribal communities in developing health and wellness programs, all with the help from a more than $1 million grant. The new initiative will focus on the Southwest, Upper Midwest, and Southern Plains regions. During this month in 2011, a healing totem pole began a journey from Washington State to Maryland. It was carved with stories of healing, hope, and knowledge, and stopped in tribal communities along the way. The totem pole was created by a Lummi carver and commissioned for an exhibit at the Library of Medicine. The exhibit examined concepts of health and medicine among Native people. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, you are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Joan Pardis. It's not Monday, my usual day. I'm helping out today. Jeff Brown, who's here, he's the engineer and producer of the show and does a great job at it. And, of course, you are listening to KTOO News Juno. So in the studio with Jeff and I today are Mila Cosgrove and Helena Fagan. Helena is the executive director of the Shambhala Center, and Mila is intricately involved with an upcoming workshop weekend for teens. Is that correct, Mila?
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about, is this new for you to have a workshop? Shambhala Center is about meditation. I'm assuming Helena's going to fill us in a little bit more about the center in a little bit. But is this the first time that you're reaching out specifically to teenagers?
Well, this workshop is unique for the center. We have had some children-related programs, some teen-related programs in the past, but this is geared specifically for teens. And one of the things that makes this a little bit unique is we're combining both a little bit of time at the center, but we're also going to do an overnight retreat out at the shrine. So we're really excited to create a container just for teens around mindfulness and mindfulness in action.
Wow, that sounds great. So what are the ages that this opportunity is open to?
Well, it's a wide age range. We're sort of just opening it up to teens, and we're going to see what the response is. So any middle school to high school level would be appropriate. We'll probably rely on the older kids who come to be in more of a leadership role with the younger kids, and we've got a slate of activity that will appeal to all ages.
Okay, let's go through that. So when is the workshop? When is the weekend workshop?
It's October 12th. It starts at about 11 o'clock out at the Jubilee Cabin out at the Shrine of St. Therese. And it'll be overnight, and the kids will need to leave the next day about 11 a.m. again.
Okay. And is this open to teens and parents, or is it only open to teens?
Well, we won't have room for all the parents to come, so it's really geared to teens. If some of the parents are interested in coming out and helping some during the day, you know, and we've got one who may be staying with us, but we have several staff members who will be there, and so, yeah, it's really geared for the kids.
Okay, so that's October 12th at the Shrine, and what is the program like?
Well, we have a teacher we're flying up from Los Angeles. Her name is Kelly McLean, and she's pretty excited about coming up. She's a young Shambhala person, teacher, and she's been working with teens in meditative art programs since she was 18 herself. So she's designing the program for us, and it's going to be a lot of fun. One of the big draws is we're going to be making and shooting our own bows and arrows, kudo, which is a Zen archery. We're going to be doing ikebana, Zen flower arranging, some calligraphy. We're also going to, if we can, we'll have a fire on the beach, some meditative walks. We'll do some introduction to meditation and some discussion groups. But mostly we're going to be doing things, mindfulness in action. So we're going to be combining these contemplative arts with meditation to just enjoy being in the present moment and being really mindful about what we're doing.
That sounds wonderful. How many participants can you have?
Well, we don't have that much space in the overnight, but we are hoping to get at least 10 to 15 kids.
Well, that's great. So how do people sign up?
They can email us at the Juno Shambhala Center. Our address is Drala, D-R-A-L-A, at junoshambhala.org. And if they go to our website, that might help them get there, too. It's juno.shambhala.org.
Okay, and what is the cost associated with it?
There is no cost because we received a grant from the Juno. It's a branch of the Juno Community Foundation. The Youth Action Committee Fund gave us a grant, and our council matched that grant. So there's no cost involved.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
There is an opportunity for people to come this Sunday from 4 to 6 at the Shambhala Center to find out more about the program. So we're hopeful that the teens that are interested in coming will come along, bring a parent who's no doubt wants a little bit more information from us about what exactly is going to go on. But it'll be an opportunity to get to know one another, talk a little bit about mindfulness, and basically have a social connection with people before we head out. So people get to know each other a little bit. That would be another way to register. People could just come and demonstrate their interest at that point.
That sounds great. So I was under the impression, I wanted to say that I made a mistake. It is not an open house for the Shambhala Center. It's an open house for this particular weekend workshop for teens.
Right, and it is a kind of an open house, but it's a little more structured than that. We have some planned introduction to mindfulness activities, which we think will be really fun. And, you know, we'll have some refreshments and a chance to chat and ask questions and answers. So.
Okay, this sounds really wonderful. So let's talk a little bit. So this is an upcoming event that's sponsored by the center, Shambhala Center, mm-hmm. and funded in part through the Juno Community Foundation, which is wonderful, and it's for teens, and it's October 12th at the Shrine for an Overnight, an Introduction to Mindfulness, it sounds like a very young, engaging teacher. Let's say that name one more time, so if people are interested, they can maybe search for her on the web and find out more about her.
Okay, her name is Kelly McLean, M-A-C, capital L-E-A-N, and kids might also like to know she's also a stand-up comic and an actress in Los Angeles, and she blogs for the Huffington Post.
Okay, she's getting cooler and more interesting.
Yeah.
So this is really interesting.
Probably
a stand-up, mindful stand-up comic.
A lot cooler than either Helene or I. No offense,
way
Helene.
No, way cooler than we are. And she grew up in the Shambhala tradition. Her parents are teachers, and so she's been around this all of her life.
Oh, wow, that sounds really wonderful. So, but let's talk a little bit about the Shambhala Center itself now. So what is it? What's its mission? How can people participate?
Yeah.
Do you have to be somebody who knows a lot about meditation? Is it only for expert meditators?
There is
no,
not at all. We're open for everybody, and we are part of a global community. There are over 200 centers around the world with thousands of members, and basically we teach meditation. The view is that every human being has a fundamental nature of goodness and intelligence, and that this can be cultivated through meditation. And through meditation in our daily lives and contemplation. And it's all about waking up. It takes a lot of courage to wake up, and that's what we'll be working with the kids on, too, how to be present for our lives and be more aware of looking at our thought patterns and the habits we have and how they either help us or can create objects for us. We offer classes the full range. We just had a level one this weekend, which is for beginners. We also have another class starting Thursday night, Meditation in Everyday Life, which will meet every week on Thursday evenings from 5:15 to 7:15 for 5 weeks. We have one of our dear senior teachers from California is teaching live online just for us. We still have a little space in that class, but that's a really good place to begin also. We have a wide array of things going on. Check our website. We have things like we have a senior teacher coming up in December, Acharya Susan Chapman, who started the center, and she's doing a weekend on death and dying. So we have a huge array of opportunities from people, everything from contemplative arts to meditation to contemplative practices. And we're really focused on society and creating enlightened society and believing that society is good, just as humans, each human is good, so is society.
So it's a natural offshoot that you would be reaching out to teens. So it just seems so perfect that to introduce teenagers to maybe a wider outlook or a different outlook onto life.
That's right. And one of the hopes is that the teens that come to this will be intrigued and interested, and that perhaps out of that will arise a community for teens, so that there'll be an ongoing, hopefully an ongoing aspect to this as well.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is Juno Afternoon. We're talking to Helena Fagan and Mila Cosgrove. They are organizing a meditation retreat for teens October 12th. It's free due to the generosity of the Juno Community Foundation and its Youth Action Fund. And if you want more information, Helena's going to give you the contact information right now.
Okay. Our email address is Drala, D-R-A-L-A, at junoshambhala.org. And our website is juno.shambhala.org.
Okay. And then this Sunday from 4 to 6 at the center, there is a program about to introduce people to what the weekend program will be. And where is the center?
The center is downtown. It's on Franklin Street in the Emporium Mall, the building where the Nickelodeon Goldtown Theater and the Heritage Coffee Shop are. It's upstairs, so you could come in the back door on Shattuck Lane, go up to the second floor, and follow the signs, and you will find us down the hall.
Great. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, John, for having us.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 10th of September, 2013. It was on this day, 2008, engineers flipped the switch to turn on the world's largest machine, the Large Hadron Collider. Very first time. A ring 27 kilometers around, that's about 17 miles, buried deep below the Alps in Switzerland and France, housing a series of superconducting magnets in a variety of sizes, magnets that focus and direct beams of particles around the ring. And these magnets are so powerful, they have to be kept chilled to a temperature of minus 271 degrees Celsius, even colder than outer space. Two particle beams, no thicker than a human hair, make their way around the collider in opposite directions. The magnetic fields coax the beams to go faster and faster until they approach the speed of light, and then the two beams smash into each other in front of a particle detector, like shooting two needles at each other from a distance of 10 kilometers and trying to get them to meet each other exactly in the middle. The particles break up into subparticles, which exist for just a fraction of a second before they stick together or they disappear. And by studying the way the subparticles behave in that split second, particle physicists hope they can get a glimpse of what happened during the Big Bang. When it's running at peak speed, the LHC can produce as many as 550 million collisions per second. The Large Hadron Collider was shut down this past February so it could undergo an upgrade. And when it reopens in 2015, scientists will use it to study things like dark matter, dark energy, and supersymmetry. It's the birthday of one of the best-selling poets in America, Mary Oliver, born Maple Heights, Ohio, outside of Cleveland, 1935. Dropped out of college, made a pilgrimage to the estate in upstate New York where Edna St. Vincent Millay had lived. And though Millay had been dead for a while, her sister Norma still lived there, and she took Mary Oliver in. And it was there on Edna St. Vincent Millay's estate that Mary Oliver met Molly Malone Cook, who'd come to pay a visit too. Mary Oliver and Molly Cook fell in love. They moved to Provincetown, Massachusetts. Cook became Oliver's literary agent. And after she died in 2005, Mary Oliver published a collection entitled Thirst, Poems About Her Grief. And it's the birthday of the biologist and science historian Stephen Jay Gould, born in Queens, New York, 1941, known for his essays on natural history and for explaining complicated scientific theories in a way that most people can understand them, in books such as The Flamingo's Smile, Bully for Brontosaurus. Here's a poem for today by John Updike, entitled Thunderstorm in Dorset, Vermont. It needs green hills to host a thunderstorm. This grumbling giant needs a place to hide and break his kindling into splinters, one stick at a time, and then in bundles, compacted threats that issue forth from where an oily darkness reigns beyond the ridge. The sizzle in our brains is overruled by such triumphant voltage overload. We witness vast concussions. Something falls down sets of stairs, the bottom step of which cracks open wide enough to show a strip of vein of naked light. All goes soft. The rain unfurls in supple gusts. The leaves flash pale, then limply steep themselves in green. A poem by John Updike, Thunderstorm in Dorset, Vermont, from his collection Endpoint, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is running the board. He's the engineer and producer of Juno Afternoon. And we've got a really interesting segment up next. I'm in the studio with Philip Durking. Philip was born and raised in Juno, and he just finished his master's in English down in Seattle. But in the time from graduating JDHS and finishing his master's in English, he's traveled to Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, to teach English. So, Philip, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you in Aarberg.
Absolutely.
So, and you also are a State Department fellow in the State Department Fellowship Program. But let's start at the very beginning. So you have been teaching English most recently in West Africa?
Correct, in Togo, so a small little country in West Africa.
Okay, but this is not your first experience teaching English abroad, is that correct?
Right. My first experience was right after finishing my undergrad. I taught in France, in the public schools in France for a year.
Wow.
And then after that, I went to Africa for the first time in Djibouti, which is, again, a small country, but over in the east side of the continent. I taught at universities there.
Okay, and this last teaching gig in Togo, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
In a small country in West Africa. Was that high school or elementary?
So this was, it was actually a different dynamic. I was actually working with English teachers this time around. So where my prior experience had been with the students, this time I was training the English teachers and working on teaching pedagogy and large classroom management and using critical thinking in the classroom skills for them to be able to teach their students English.
Wow, that must have been great.
It was really interesting. It was a very different dynamic than when working with students, because with students, you have similar objectives with being able to get them to interact in English or use critical thinking, but your focus is English, or at least helping them learn English. Whereas with teachers, you're doing your trainings in English, and while that's one perk of these trainings, your objective is to help improve them in their teaching ability. And in Africa, there's such a great need, so It was really fascinating to have the exchange of objectives in the classroom, but ultimately it was still a really great, really amazing experience.
Okay, let's roll this all the way back to you thinking about, hey, I would really like to teach abroad. What's the first steps? What does somebody do to do that?
It's to teach English abroad. It's actually becoming more and more accessible, and I think when I got into doing this, it was right at the beginning when people were first starting to think about it. I first became motivated when I was studying abroad in France, and I was meeting different people from England or United States or Canada who were teaching in different parts of the world. And so I was curious about it. And I think one great first step is to do what they call a TESOL or a TEFL certification. And it's basically, that can be anything from a university minor to an online program. It could be even just a month. There's varying degrees of or lengths of programs. But what it does is it gives you a certification so that when you apply to schools, you can say, I've had this short intensive training in teaching. And it's something that's easy. I know tons of people have done that in just after hours after work. It can be something that's extensive or short. And what it allows you to do is if you then go online and you look for private language schools, universities, public schools, you then can say you have this training. And if you want to be a teacher in the U.S. system, there's a great need for people who've had training because there's a growing number of second language learners in the U.S. public school system, so that can be an advantage. But that would be the first step I would recommend. Second step, going online. There's tons of opportunities, and there's a few different websites that are common for finding job postings as well. The big one being Dave's ESL Cafe is kind of the name that everyone will toss around initially. So those would be the first two steps. And surprisingly, it's becoming easier and easier and easier to do because there's just a growing need for learning English.
Okay. So ESL, for people who are not familiar with the term, it's English as a Second Language. And the TEFL or the TESOL certification stands for Teaching English.
Right. Teaching English as a Second Language or Teaching English as a Foreign Language. And essentially, it's the same thing. Foreign language is focusing on if you're teaching English abroad, where TESOL, teaching English as a Second Language, is if you're in the States teaching international students here, but similar training and basically the same training for both.
Okay. So out of all your experiences, and how long was each experience? Are you talking about a couple of months? Are you talking about a couple of years?
For me, they've been longer. France was 1 year. When I was in Djibouti, that was 2 years. And this most recent one in Togo was 1 year. And then I should add that when I was doing my master's in teaching English in the States, I was also teaching at the same time, and that was a 2 year stint. So it's been 1 to 2 years. But there are programs that take you for a month or 3 months. But I've always wanted to do these longer programs because it gave me the opportunity to explore a new country, travel during holidays. So the lengths can vary.
Okay. So I want to talk about your experiences in Africa, but before we get there, I'd like to talk about the State Department Fellowship that you were a part of. How does somebody get involved with that, and what does it mean?
That's a really good question. Interestingly enough, the State Department, I have discovered this year, is actually really invested in promoting English language education for them. They find that, first of all, it's a good public diplomacy tool to be able to interact with different countries, and they have found that most countries are really wanting training in English, and so it fits nicely. So they've been investing a lot of money into English language education abroad, and they have a few different fellowship programs. And this one, it's funded by the Bureau of Educational Cultural Affairs, which is the same department that funds Fulbright fellowships. And basically what they look for is someone who has a master's, preferably in teaching English as a second language, but not completely exclusive to that, and who has some experience teaching. Maybe I think it's 2 to 3 years right now. And what it is, it's a fellowship to take these professionals and put them in places all over the world in varying capacities. It depends what, and it's different projects. So my project was a teacher training project. I had a colleague in Cote d'Ivoire who was teaching English to police officers. I had a colleague in Zambia who's teaching English to journalists. But these are all over the world, and it depends the project, and it's really a fascinating program. They take care of you really well. You really get to interact with a country and an educational system in a pretty profound way, and I would really recommend it for anyone who's in the field already or who is thinking of getting into the field.
And is that what you did when you were working with the teachers?
Correct.
That was part of the fellowship. Okay, so and up next, you're moving to D.C. and you're working for a nonprofit educational organization. But before we go there, the question that people are going to say, like, what's it like in Africa? I mean, like, what do you want to share with Junoites about your experience there? What should we really know about somebody who's been there?
Oh, absolutely, and a great question, and that's an interesting one too, because I think for the United States in general, there are some people who are very experienced with Africa, but there's a lot of I think Africa's still a mystery for a lot of the United States. So the first thing I would say is it's definitely very different, and that is what everyone would expect, and it's very true. But I would say that it's a much more fascinating and wonderful place than I think a lot of people would ever consider it being. When you look at the news, you're hearing a lot about the problems, and there definitely are a lot of struggles on the continent. But you have a lot of real incredible things there. In terms of history, you have everything from, on the east side of the continent, ancient Christian and Muslim religious sites, to the west side of the continent, where you have historical slave trading posts and routes and a lot of the historical sites for the slave trade. It's a lot more diverse than people ever think about. When I lived in East Africa, I lived in West Africa, and it felt like two different continents. But you have real wonderful people. Generally, everywhere you go, people are going to be extremely nice, extremely friendly. You have very beautiful landscapes. It's not just the kind of dry deserts that people assume it is. You have tropical jungles, you have lush mountains, you do have dry deserts, but you also have big savannas. Very beautiful place. And it's actually a lot easier and safer to be in and travel than people realize. Some places aren't safe, and that is true, but I've been to places that were safer than big cities in the United States, Togo included. I felt safer in Togo than I ever felt in a big American city. And you just have a general sense that people are concerned about their neighbors more than big cities. So I would say definitely different, definitely not an easy travel destination, but very worth it, and it's the kind of place that leaves an impression on you long after you go, and a lot safer than people would think.
Okay, well, let's specifically talk about your last experience in Togo. So was it a big city? Were you in a city? Were you in a village? Where were you?
This last one was pretty dynamic. I was based in the capital, which wasn't very big, but it was about 600,000, so a big city, but definitely not a metropolis. But I had the opportunity to travel all over the country for doing my teacher training seminar. So I got to go north to south, regional capitals, small villages. So I got to see, and this is one thing that's true about Africa, that it changes quite a bit. In the big city, it's dilapidated, but you can find a lot of the amenities that you need. There are good restaurants. There is infrastructure. You can live a comfortable lifestyle. And then when you go to the village, it's definitely mud huts and no electricity and practically subsistence living. So there's a huge range in the quality of life. And that was one thing surprising to me. Almost every country I'd go to, you'd find that capitals, you could find extreme poverty, but also real comfortable lifestyle. But as soon as you left the capital, things went rural very quickly, very, very quickly.
And what kind of crops? When you talk about a subsistence lifestyle, what kind of crops are...
Things from a lot of the base of people's diets are based around yams or potatoes and kind of a starchy substance. Then you grow carrots, onions, tomatoes, peppers. So a lot, and then a lot of things were based also around meat, but everything from common meat to cows, chickens, fish to bush rat rodent that they have there to antelope. Or if when I was on the east side, there was even camel that sometimes people eat or goat. So it ranges quite a bit, depending where you are.
Okay. So your last experience was with adults, but let's go to where you were. That was West Africa. So let's go to East Africa. Do you want to share a story? I'm sure you have many stories about working with the kids.
Let's see here. In East Africa was with university students, but there was one experience that really left an impression on me. It was when one of my university students actually invited me to come to see his school that he was teaching at. And at that point, I didn't realize he was actually working at the same time. And so after class, I got on a bus with him. We went on a 30-minute bus ride to the neighborhood where he taught in, where I discovered that he and several other students were running their own small kind of private English language school for the youth in their neighborhood, the neighborhood kids. And it was pretty fascinating because, I mean, they're in these very much what someone would call a shanty town, corrugated metal building, very haphazardly put together desks. And these are my students that I saw were actually using stuff that I was teaching them in class, and then they were going and teaching it to these students, and they weren't really charging their students. It was more just to kind of give an opportunity for the youth in their community to learn English. But what not only was that incredible just to see they were doing that, but the ability of the students was really, really strong. The students who were learning there were all really strong in English, and so it left a big impression, first on the kind of motivation of people to want to get education and learn English, and how much even little kids are going to be serious and dedicated for their studies there. But then also the motivation of university students to have the means to give back. In this situation, they weren't earning money from doing this, or at least I think they're earning a little bit, but it wasn't substantial. It was really just an opportunity to help out their community. And so that's what impressed me, is that in Africa, you really have a thirst for education. You really have people who want education and really see the benefits for it. So it was very humbling and inspiring at the same time.
That sounds great. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Philip Durkin, who just came back from traveling and teaching abroad. And I have two more questions, and then we'll have to move on. So my question is, what does the ability of speaking English in Africa, what is the value of that?
That's a great question, and that is one that I always enjoy promoting, because I think at this point, English language has become more than just a fun thing to learn or even just another second language to add on. It's become a resource for anybody anywhere around the world. And in Africa, I discovered how it could be a resource that could change your economic mobility, it could change your livelihood. If you know English, pretty much every business in Africa needs to know English, because even if it's not an English-speaking country like Togo or Djibouti, they're going to be surrounded by English-speaking countries or countries that are going to do business in English. In Djibouti, the only economy they had was based around trade, and with the countries they trade with, they had to trade in English. So basically, the only way people could get real jobs was if they knew English. In Togo, they're right by Ghana, and they're not far from Nigeria. A lot of the businesses there involve having people who need to know English. So even if they never get to the United States or never get to England, even in their own continent, they need to know English just to get employability. So it's fun. It's handy just as knowing the language, but it's also, especially places of poverty, it's a key to getting a job. And so it's just become something that is even more value is become incredibly valuable.
That's fascinating. I assumed that was the case, but I didn't know. So thank you for clarifying for that. And so what's next? Where do you go next? What's the next job?
So next will be sort of a transit. I'll be transitioning out of the classroom and into more of a role of managing these kind of education projects. I was recently hired at a nonprofit called World Learning, and they're based in D.C., and they basically do education projects all over the world. And I'll be working on a project that is focusing on developing an English and literacy program in Pakistan, though I'll be based in D.C. And I'm excited. It'll be a new role because I won't be in the classroom, but I'll be using, hopefully, as my experience on the ground to help in managing and starting up one of these programs. So I'm excited to see what the new challenge brings.
That sounds great. So, Philip, thank you so much for coming back to your hometown and coming into the studio today and sharing your experiences. It just is really amazing that your education here in Juneau, the capital here in Alaska, has really opened up so many doors for you. I guess I'm not making any value statement on our school here, but like a Juneau boy to go so far is what I'm saying. Is like it's really inspiring to know that there's a whole big world out there, and learning English and teaching English really has some value and can really change lives.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in today.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back with the next guest. Listening to Juneau Afternoon. We just wrapped up a segment with Philip Durking, who is teaching abroad. If you're interested to find out about some of his experiences, you can check out his blog at Togo Tales. That's TOGOTALES .blogspot. And if you search him, there's been some articles that he published in the Juneau Empire as well, as if you're looking for that. But here in town, we in the studio, we have Jenny Gomez again. And Jenny is... you are the Alaska Council, Honorary Council to the Philippines.
Turn that around.
Go ahead.
I'm the Honorary Council of the Philippines to the state of Alaska.
Okay, and your full name is Jenny Gomez Strickler.
Yes.
And Jenny and I chatted when she first got this honor, so it's great to have you back and
hear
what you're doing. And then also I have Jim Clark, who is with the Juneau World Fair Council.
And all I wanted to say about... we're so happy to have Jenny coming to speak to us about the interest of the Philippine government in Alaska as expressed by making her the honorary consul. So we're delighted to have her at 5 o'clock tomorrow in the Egan Room of the Centennial Hall, and we're hoping for a nice turnout to listen to Jenny.
Okay. So, Jenny, what are you going to be talking about tomorrow? Give us some highlights.
Well, a number of things, because not a lot of folks know what the Honorary Council does or is supposed to do. So I'm going to be talking about my position responsibilities, the purpose for the position here in Alaska. I'm going to touch a little bit about the histories of Filipinos in Alaska, a little bit about the economy of the Philippines, and then what Alaska has to offer, and also about the trade mission, the legislative trade mission that took place last November, which I was a part of, and then about the goals or and the projects that are in the works.
That sounds great. And when you received this honor, that was about when did we chat? When did you get this honor?
We chatted last in June when I was sworn into office. But my appointment was actually made in October, on October 8th of 2012.
Okay, yeah. So what do you want to talk about here today? Do you want to talk about the trade mission? Do you want to talk about the goals? What do you think would be the best use of our time today without giving away the whole talk for tomorrow? Just a little tease to make sure that room is packed tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the Egan Room.
Well, I can talk a little bit about the projects, the goals and the projects that we have in mind, because they're a spinoff from the trade mission that occurred last November. We're going to do, first of all, we're busy working on possibly holding a seafood festival in Manila in, sometime in 2014. There was, on our trade mission, there was big interest in Alaska's fish. And what's interesting, I'll throw this little tidbit out there, is when people heard we were from Alaska, they actually made association with three things. Alaska is known as the brand of milk in the Philippines. Or they hear Alaska and they think of the basketball team that's sponsored by the milk company. But when they hear state of Alaska, everyone says fish. And not a lot of folks know that there's five different kinds of salmon. They just think fish, you know, one salmon is salmon. And so there was great interest in Alaska fish, primarily salmon.
Right. That's so fascinating. That's really invaluable knowledge, because we might think that they have the same frame of reference and think of the same thing. Like, how would we know that they have a brand of milk that's named that? So that's really invaluable information. And a sea fest there would be fantastic.
Yes, we're working on that with the governor's office and with Representative Kathy Munoz, and hopefully we're trying to get interest among the local fishermen. We hope to tap some of the larger companies as well as local fishermen when this all comes together. We, meaning the governor's office and Representative Munoz and myself, hope to be speaking with ASME, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, at their next meeting, and hopefully we can get them interested in joining us to make this happen. We also have folks working on the Philippine side to try to bring this all together.
That sounds wonderful. So, Jenny, we don't have a tremendous amount of time this time around. I have a question for you, and then I have a question for Jim. So, how's your new job? How is it being?
My new job is it's exciting. It's going very well. Part of this job, besides promoting tourism, trade, and investments, is to process documents that are acceptable in the Philippines. So I've done a number of those already. I pretty much learned on the job. It's going quickly. I have good support from the consulate in San Francisco. So it's going very well.
That's great. Thank you for all you do. And Jim, my last question for you is, can you tell, most of our audience will be familiar with JWAC, Juneau World Affairs Council, but can you tell us a little bit about the council and what they do?
Well, the council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that tends coming to our Affairs is for free. We have worked out an arrangement with K2 TV and 360 North so that we make DVDs of all our programs, and they show several times around the state. Our interest is in foreign affairs and how those affairs might relate to Alaska, and bringing folks from all over the world, including from Juneau, where they have interesting content on foreign issues to speak to us. And Jenny's a perfect example of somebody with great knowledge about foreign affairs. It's homegrown. We have speakers that come from Washington when they're en route to Asia. We have them. We team up with the Anchorage World Affairs Council and have people come that speak to both of us. So we've over the years, we've worked out a pretty good set of programs to bring world affairs here, and we're always anxious for more members and hope that some of the people who are listening today will be there tomorrow and sign up as members going forward.
That sounds great. And do you meet monthly? Is there a monthly programming?
We have more than that if we can arrange it. So one of the things I do want to say is we're going to have a very big forum on Canada with the University of Alaska Southeast that'll take place from the 17th through the 19th out at UAS, and it should be very interesting because it's surprising how little Alaskans know about our next-door neighbor, Canada. Mm. So it'll be a very, very interesting forum.
That's great. If people want more information, where can they go for more information about the organization?
JWAC.org.
Okay. All right. So tomorrow night, JWAC meeting Wednesday at 5 at the Egan Room, Centennial Hall, and Jenny Gomez-Strickler, the Honorary Alaska Council to the Philippines, I got it in the right order that time, will be talking about the Alaska-Philippine relations, exploring the possibilities. Thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is inviting community members to nominate women whose professional and volunteer work supports YWCA Alaska's mission of eliminating racism, empowering women. They are now accepting nominations to ensure that women around the state and in a wide spectrum of our communities are recognized for their achievements. Nomination deadline, Monday, September 16th. More information at ywcaak.org. The 24th annual YWCA Alaska BP Women of Achievement Awards will be presented December 5th.
Did you know that Alaska possesses 90% of the estimated potential tidal power in the entire United States? Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to making Alaska a world leader in clean, renewable energy. Find out more on the web at realaska.org. This message brought to you by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
Hello, you're listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown's at the board. He's the engineer and producer, and he booked this show, and it seems like three out of our four guests, it is a wanderlust show today, lots of travel. So in the studio right now, we have Brita and Cheyenne and Roxy. They are part of the JDHS drama team, drama department, and they went to the Fringe Fest this summer, which is in Scotland. It's a very honored and revered theatrical experience that has been around for, these guys should know, what, like probably 100 years.
Oh, yeah, plus.
Yeah, and so they're going to talk a little bit about what their experience, but they also want to talk about what's happening here in Juneau. So, ladies, how was Scotland?
Like, fantastic. Like, yeah. It's kind of hard to put in words, exactly.
How long were you there?
We were there for, like, 2 weeks.
Yeah, just a little bit over 2 weeks.
We were in Scotland for 10 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we were in London also before that for a few days.
Okay, and what did you guys do in London? Let's start there.
Oh, so much. We got to go see Billy Elliot at the West End there, and it was an amazing show. We all loved it.
And we also got to see Stomp as well.
And then we went to go to Stratford, which is the birthplace of Shakespeare, and we saw a Shakespeare show called As You Like It.
Completely amazing. It was it was an up-to-date version, and it had just the most amazing cast I think I've ever seen. So I was definitely awe-inspired by that cast.
Okay, so you were in London, and already it was game over. It was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And then you actually went to Scotland, which was the whole purpose of the trip. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how was it? I mean, what was the stage like? What was the audiences like? What was it like to be part of, you know, the whole buzz of the theatrical world?
It was a little bit overwhelming, honestly. I think when we got there, like, I mean, we had these preconceived notions. It's like, oh, it's going to be this big thing. We were like, yeah, it's going to be big. And then we got there, and we're like, oh, it's that big. Like, there's so many people everywhere.
Okay, let's roll it back. So let's say you don't know what the Fringe Fest is. Which one of you can talk about what the Fringe Fest is?
Well, there's a lot of fringe festivals in the world, and it's just a bunch of theatrical, like, a bunch of shows like that. And the one in Edinburgh is the biggest one. It has 45,000 shows and just an average audience of about 6 people, and it's just so many shows, like, for theater, and it's just amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a large festival that the population in Edinburgh actually doubles for the month of August when the festival is going on.
Yeah. Our tour guide had said that 1 out of every 3 people there in Scotland actually live there, and the other 2 are just visiting for the festival.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really fascinating to see how many people love theater and want to be there for it.
And it's not necessarily a youth festival. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
So you were a high school drama team that was there, a drama department that was there, but it's not a high school.
No.
No, it's kind of amazing because it's people of all ages from all around the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many times did you perform?
4.
4 times while we were there, which is saying quite a bit because there's within even the American High School Theater Festival, which is what we were part of, that little section of high school, there was so many shows there. There was probably like, I don't even know, like 30 or so shows of the high school,
mm-hmm.
and each one performed 4 times, and then plus all the thousands of other venues that were there. So the fact that we had audiences, I mean, in general, to get to us was amazing. And we had good audiences while we were there.
Yeah. So where did you guys stay?
We stayed at Pollock Halls, which is like a kind of university setting there. So each of us had our own room, which was really
fantastic.
Fun.
It was great.
How many people went?
We had 17.
Yep.
17 of us.
17 students and 4 adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, we didn't go by ourselves.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
Not yet, ladies. So, okay, so that was amazing. You probably saw some great plays.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we did.
I'm going to individually ask each of you which was your favorite play, and then we'll move on to the plays that are happening here in Juneau. So, Cheyenne, which one did you like the best?
I really liked, we saw Avenue Q, which was a show just playing in Edinburgh, and it was amazing. It's done with puppets, and I've never seen anything like it, so it was really great.
Right. That the Broadway tour was up in Anchorage last year of Avenue Q, so that's great. So Avenue Q was your favorite. What about you, Roxy?
The best show I saw in Edinburgh, I think, was probably The Imaginary Invalid. It was just this crazy show that it was one of the American High School Theater Festivals, and it was amazing and hard to believe that was just high school students putting it on.
And that's Tennessee Williams, isn't it? Imaginary Invalid?
Yes.
I think it is. I think it is. You seem to be uncertain, too. But we might be wrong, but I think Imaginary Invalid is a classic Tennessee Williams play. I remember the play. It was great. So that really moved you. That was outstanding for you. And what about you, Britta?
Well, for me, as part of the theater festival, they have random things going on as well. And I was out with some of my friends, and we saw a comedy show that was held in the attic of a pub there. And we were very, very sketched out. We're like, oh, this doesn't seem like it's a very good show. But it turned out to be one of my favorite things that I saw there at the festival. Just this 3-man comedy show in a room much smaller than this one with about 10 people. And it was fantastic. I loved it.
It sounds like a great experience.
Yeah.
Okay, so here in Juneau, Alaska, what is coming up for the Juneau Douglas High School Drama Department?
Well, right now I am, and I think about a few weeks or so, we have our first show coming up, which is a play. It's called Almost Maine. It is it's a really, really fantastic show. It's about all these different relationships and couples and the way that that works. And what we're going to do for that special is we're making our theater, our big theater, into a black box. And so we're going to have the curtain pulled and have bleachers and stuff set up as a sort of circle in the round. And we're going to be doing that for 1 weekend only, and we're going to have 2 shows a day. So if you liked it, you can come and see it again. Tell your friends and come see that one.
Is this the first time we've ever had Theater in the Round? I mean, I know that Theater in the Rough has done Theater in the Round, but it sounds like transforming that place, and a black box is a more intimate setting.
Yeah, which will be good because, I mean, obviously intimate material. We've done it once before for a summer show that we did called The Last 5 Years, which Miss Moore produced with 2 of our former students. So, yeah, we're excited to try to do that again. It was really fun.
Okay, and do you have the dates on that?
Goodness, I don't have the dates on that one. I'm so sorry. It's going to be coming up here, I think, about the end of probably like mid-October, probably end of September area. So
right.
You'll see more publicity for that.
That drama department's great about putting flyers out. So something you definitely want to look for. And then what's up on the slate?
For our musical this year, we're doing Spamalot.
Oh, my.
Yes, oh, my. And it's going to be a really big show. And then we're doing another play after that. And we're actually doing a show that we saw in Scotland, which...
Roxy's favorite.
Yeah, we're doing The Imaginary Invalid.
Oh, good. Yeah. All right, so you have 2 plays and you have 1 huge musical.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well... I'll tell you, you guys don't rest on your laurels. You just keep on going, which is great.
Always.
All right. So we should keep an eye out for the next show, which is Almost Maine, and then Spamalot, and then Imaginary Invalid.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to do the weather, and we're going to have to wrap it up for the night.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
This is Bird Note. Sound recordist and photographer Garrett Vinn spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in the mountains of Lesotho. He met a chief who wanted the people to take better care of the wildlife, especially an extraordinary bird. Here's Garrett to describe what the chief did.
The first thing that he was able to do was to prove to the villagers that a bird that lived there called the lammergeier or bearded vulture was not a threat to their livestock. This bird is an amazingly big vulture. It has a wingspan of almost 10 feet. So the lammergeier is a species of vulture that basically eats bone marrow. It'll take bones from deceased animals, pick them up, soar with them in the air, drop the bones, and then they splinter open, and then it devours the bones. The people thought that these vultures killed their animals, which they didn't. So the chief built a corral beneath the nesting cliffs near his village, put a bunch of sheep in there and left them there for a long period of time. And the villagers saw that these sheep went completely unharmed. He then went and removed the sheep, put a bunch of bones in the area, and then the birds started coming and collecting the bones, breaking them, and eating them. And the villagers saw this, and he had taught them a very simple lesson in such a basic way, that this bird was not a threat to them or their livestock.
To see a truly exceptional video about the lammergeier, produced by the BBC, begin at our website, birdnote.org.
Hello, you've been listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host today, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the engineer and producer of the show. The weather today, periods of rain tonight, patchy fog late. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, rain likely, highs around 60. So you've been tuned in here for Juneau Afternoon for your local news, but All Things Considered is up next. And then at 5 o'clock, President Obama is speaking to the American public. That's here on KTOO. You could listen live on the radio. You could check it out on the web. So thank you for joining us tomorrow and full of hosts.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. K2 also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9.